vacation an option for much the same reason. The risk was great, the possible benefits almost non-existent. Instead, my sister would be treated with chemotherapy. After the initial consultation, my sister would be given a combination of three different drugs that had proven to be the most successful in treating the types of tumors afflicting my sister. Yet the odds weren't good. Chemotherapy is essentially poison. The hope is that the poison kills the tumors before it kills the person. While it's effective in many types of cancer, it's far less effective in the brain. The blood-brain barrier, think of it as a wall between your brain and the rest of your body, makes reaching the high concentrations necessary to kill the tumors almost impossible to attain. They could, however, sometimes control the growth rate of the tumors, or, if lucky, even stop the growth entirely. "So what does that mean for Dana?" I asked Micah on the phone. "They won't know anything until after she's on the drugs." "But she has a chance, right?" "Yeah, there's a chance, but..." Micah trailed off. "But the odds aren't good," I finished. "They wouldn't say. All they would tell me is that the regimen she's going on offers the best chance for her." "What happens if the tumor stops growing but doesn't actually die?" "I don't know." "Could they tell you how long the tumor might stop growing if the drug works?" "No," he said. "To be honest, Nick, I didn't get any answers at all. Not because she doesn't have good doctors, but because they can't even begin to make an educated guess right now. I've told you all that I know. They say they'll probably know more in 3 months when Dana gets her next CAT scan." "What are we supposed to do until then?" "Wait and see what happens." "That's what they told you?" "In those words, exactly." After that, our life began to fall into a distinct 3-month cycle, almost like a holding pattern. Dana started chemotherapy with Micah by her side. As the poison began to filter into her system, my brother held her hand. The news about Dana made everything that much harder. Writing was a struggle the first couple months of the year, and my book tour for Message in a Bottle lasted throughout March and April, again stranding Kat alone with the kids. While on the road and away from home, I worried about my sister's health and hated the fact that I wasn't able to work with Ryan. I continued to write when I returned. In the end, I nearly completed a novel before throwing it out in its entirety. It simply wasn't working. As soon as I got back, I started on Ryan's speech again, facing one struggle after the next. By then, specialists had revised the diagnosis once more, this time to CAPD, or Central Auditory Processing Disorder. Essentially, it's dyslexia of sound. For whatever reason, sounds are jumbled into something like random noise, making speech and comprehension extremely difficult. By then, neither Kat nor I cared what the expert said was wrong with Ryan. We simply continued to work with him. After a year, he'd finally reached the point where he understood that words represented objects, and Ryan could repeat nearly everything I suggested. Questions were a massive stumbling block. He couldn't comprehend the idea behind statements beginning with what, who, when, why, or how. For weeks, I spent hours trying different ways to get through to him. I'd point to a picture of a tree. "Tree," I'd say. "Tree," he'd repeat. "Good, great job," I'd praise. I'd point to the tree again. "What's this?" "What's this?" he'd repeat. "No, no, it's a tree." "No, no, it's a tree," he'd repeat. Meanwhile, the clock continued to tick. On his next birthday, he'd be 5 years old. In April, while I was on tour, Dana went in for her next CAT scan, and she called me on the road with the news right after she'd received the results. "The tumor has shrunk by half," she said. "That's fantastic," I said. Oh, man, was I worried. I was a nervous wreck the last week and a half. "I'll bet you were. I was too, but this is great news. If it keeps working like this, it might be gone by the next time I go in." "Did the doctor say that?" "No, but I think it will. It's already down by half. More than half, actually." "That's wonderful," I said again. "I'm going to beat this thing." "I know you will." By May 1998, after hundreds and hundreds of hours, I finally stumbled onto something that helped Ryan understand what a question was. I began to whisper the question and shout the answer before he could repeat the question. "What's this?" I'd whisper, pointing to the tree. "Tree!" I'd quickly shout. Ryan, startled by my outburst, would say, "Tree!" almost on instinct. "That's right," I'd cheer. "Great job! It's a tree!" Gradually, he learned how to respond to some questions. What and who, primarily. Both major steps forward, which allowed him to finally engage in basic conversation. To learn where would take many more weeks. When, why, or how still eluded him completely. Nor could he ride a bike. Nor could he write with a pencil. Nor could he tie his shoes. Kat worked with him in all those areas, and she showed no less determination than I. She, like I, was determined to help Brian get better, no matter what it took. Both of us wanted Ryan to be mainstreamed when he started school. We wanted him to attend regular classes with regular kids. We wanted Ryan to be accepted as normal. But often it felt as if we were running out of time. In a little over a year, Ryan would be starting kindergarten, and the clock continued to tick. At the end of May 1998, Kat and I spent a couple of weeks in California, visiting with both Micah and Anna. I served as best man in Micah's wedding, a beautiful event attended by friends and family. A few days after he returned from his honeymoon, he took my sister in for her next appointment. "I'm sure it's better," Dana told him on the way in. "I feel great." But it wasn't. Instead, the tumor had grown again. Now it was the size of 3 grapes, with tentacles spreading out from it. Dana's chemotherapy regimen was changed, but we all knew that the new drugs were generally not as effective as the first. Still, there was hope. In one clinical study, one patient out of 12 had been completely cured with the drug she was now on. We still had reason to hope, the doctors assured us. To be on the safe side, however, Micah and Dana, along with a couple of relatives, flew to MD Anderson in Houston, one of the most renowned cancer centers in the country, for a second opinion. The doctors concluded that she was receiving the highest standard of care, and that had Dana been a patient there, they would be doing nothing different. When talking to us, Dana remained optimistic. "I'm going to beat it," she would say. "I know you are," both Micah and I would reassure her. Afterward, Micah and I would say the same things to each other. Still, we spoke to each other less frequently that year than we had in the past, 1 or 2 calls a week. Not the 3 or 4 calls that had once been normal. Kat and I continued working with Ryan. Micah was adjusting to married life and working hard. He'd also begun remodeling his home and was spending as much time with Dana as he could. The phone calls were often painful. Talking to Micah reminded me of Dana, and vice versa. And even though I'd talked to Dana as frequently as I did with my brother, I could never escape the image of something terrible growing inside her, something irreversible. That summer, drawing inspiration from my sister, I wrote A Walk to Remember. Jamie, the main character, embodied all the wonderful attributes of my sister and all the worries I had for her future. It was the first time I'd ever cried while writing. In the end, I dedicated it in memory of my parents and to Micah and Dana. My sister, though she knew it was about her, refused to read it. "I don't want to know how it ends," she said. By autumn, my sister's tumor had shrunk. Not much, but progress nonetheless. She stayed on the same drug regimen, and we bided our time until winter, when she would get another CAT scan. We continued to live from 1 3-month cycle to the next. In early December, Micah and Dana, along with Bob, Christine, and the kids, flew to North Carolina to visit. While there, we all dressed in khakis and long-sleeved white shirts and sat for a family photograph taken on the beach. It still hangs in my living room today. And no matter how long you stare at it, by their appearance you would never know that anything was wrong with Dana or Ryan at all. A few weeks later, my sister called me on my birthday and sang to me. By then I couldn't help but notice that she had begun to slur words occasionally and was beginning to have difficulty understanding some things. Still, she remained positive about her condition. But a couple of days after that, she got the results from her next CAT scan. The second round of chemotherapy was failing. Her tumor was now the size of 4 grapes, and the tentacles continued to spread. She was placed on a new regimen, with new chemotherapy drugs. "This is the last of the best," we were informed. After this, everything we can try is pretty much experimental. There was still hope, however. By then, hope was becoming the only thing we could cling to. In February 1999, Micah and Dana, along with their spouses, flew to Los Angeles for the movie premiere of Message in a Bottle. That afternoon, before we attended the red carpet premiere, however, we brought my sister to Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. There, we'd made arrangements for my sister to see Dr. Keith Black, one of the finest neurosurgeons in the country. We wanted to make certain that surgery wasn't an option anywhere by anyone, even if it entailed serious risks. While we all hoped that this latest round of chemotherapy would work, we wanted to keep every conceivable option open. Micah and Dana and I, along with a few relatives, were in the room when my sister's CAT scan was placed against the light. It was the first time I'd seen one of her scans, and Micah whispered that her tumor was easy to spot. "Cancer shows up white on the scan," he explained. When the light was turned on and I saw my sister's scan, my throat constricted. White seemed to be everywhere. Still, we asked about surgery, and we were told that since the tumor had crossed the midline in her brain, surgery wasn't an option. When we asked about her chemotherapy, we were told that there was a slim possibility that it could slow the growth in a case like hers. Slow, not stop. The doctor, in his own quiet way, was telling us that it was only a matter of time. But they're doing everything for her that we would do here. When we asked about experimental drugs, the doctor explained that they were experimental for a reason. Efficacy hadn't been proven. He spent a lot of time talking about quality of life. Again, it was his way of telling us that my sister's chances were not good. By then, the tumor had begun to take its toll on my sister. Though fine in ordinary conversation, she was no longer able to fully understand the details of the doctor's explanation, and she frowned at him, missing the nuances entirely. "You're doing well," the doctor said to her. "Actually, I'm amazed at how well you're doing." Again, we understood that he was describing her condition in relative terms. Most people with a tumor like my sister's wouldn't be walking or talking at all. Toward the end of the consultation, Micah was sitting in the corner, head bowed low. As soon as the doctor left, none of us could say anything. Instead, we sat in silence for a long moment. My sister finally looked at Micah. "What was he telling us?" Dana asked Micah. Micah looked from Dana to me, then back to our sister again. He forced a smile. "He says that you're taking the right medicine," Micah answered softly. "They wouldn't be doing anything different." She nodded. "And I can't have surgery or radiation again?" "No," he said. "They don't think it would help." She blinked and looked from me to Micah. "But there's still more medicine they can give me, right? If the ones I'm on stop working?" "Yeah," Micah said. "There are a couple more things they can try." "Well, good," she said. A couple of hours later, we were surrounded by movie stars. Dana had her picture taken with Kevin Costner and Robin Wright Penn, who were both extremely gracious to my sister. But as Dana posed for the pictures, all I could do was stare at her, wondering how much time she still had. As if to escape the inevitability of what was happening, I began writing The Rescue in the spring of 1999. The story about a boy named Kyle who couldn't talk was deeply personal and emotional for me to write. It was inspired, of course, by Ryan, our fears for his future, and the work that Kat and I had been doing with him. In my spare moments, I spent time with Miles and Kat while continuing to work with Ryan. Kat had come a long way in teaching Ryan a myriad of skills, and he'd continued to improve at asking and answering questions. Still, I found myself wishing that it would be easier. I wanted nothing more than for something to suddenly click, for Ryan to start learning on his own, simply by absorbing the world around him, as other children did. But nothing ever clicked. Working with him was akin to rolling boulders up a never-ending hill. It was incredibly frustrating. I wondered why I'd been given a child with so many problems. There were frequent moments when I was angry at God, angry at what had happened, angry at the lot I'd been given. With Ryan, Kat and I had been robbed of all the joys of childhood. His wonder as he discovered the world, natural affection, his ability to learn on his own, everything about his childhood was a struggle without reward, and I railed at the unfairness of it all. I wanted someone else to do the work. I wanted someone to come in and magically solve the problem. I dreamed of the day that someone would invent a pill to make his problem go away. I was so tired by then, tired of it all, and I'd pray to God begging him to make my son better. It wasn't too much to ask, was it? I just wanted what our friends had, what our neighbors had, what everyone else seemed to have. I wanted a child like other children. And then I'd feel guilty for what I'd been thinking. Terribly guilty. It wasn't Ryan's fault. It wasn't God's or anyone's fault. And Ryan had worked so hard, harder than any young child should be expected to work. And he wasn't quitting. We'd been through fire together, and I wouldn't, couldn't give up on him. He was my son, and I loved him. And after all, no one ever said that life was fair. What you want and what you get are usually two entirely different things. With a job to do, I'd begin work with him again. I had no other choice. He'd be starting kindergarten in less than 6 months, and there was still such a long, long way to go. A month later, in April 1999, we found out Kat was pregnant, and surprisingly, my sister's tumor had stabilized again, or possibly even shrunk. Micah celebrated his first anniversary a month later, and after I called to congratulate him, he asked, "How's Ryan doing? I sure do miss that kid." Micah always asked about Ryan. Always. And he always said something kind. Over the summer, I continued working on the rescue, working with Ryan, and spending time with Miles. Kat and I marveled at her growing belly, and I woke every morning with the renewed belief that she was the most wonderful woman in the world. We also took another trip to California. Our trips out there were becoming both longer and more frequent. In the fall, Ryan started kindergarten. We spent his first day pacing the house and worrying about him endlessly. We were terrified by the thought of what would happen to him. Though he'd improved substantially, he was still so far behind in so many areas. We worried that no one would like him, that other kids would tease him, that he wouldn't be able to handle the work. Every day we waited for a phone call from the school, telling us that it would be best if we enrolled Ryan elsewhere. We prayed for him every single night. Again, I had to leave town for 2 straight months, this time while Kat was pregnant. I toured in Europe and the U.S. promoting A Walk to Remember. While on the road, I worried about Kat and worried about Ryan. And halfway through the tour, I learned that my sister's tumor had reversed itself and was growing once more. Dana was placed on experimental drugs, in experimental combinations, with no promises whatsoever. And so I worried about her, too. Almost always, interviewers would ask if I felt I'd been born under a lucky star, or if I thought my life was blessed. I never knew what to tell them. Throughout 1999, the phone calls between my brother and me continued regularly, and whenever we spoke, I began to sense his emotional exhaustion. In addition to taking over my dad's role in shuttling Dana to and from various appointments, he'd also become my sister's confidant and cheerleader, all while trying to keep her from knowing how worried he actually was. Like me, my brother was using work as an escape. His business had grown, he had nearly 30 employees, as opposed to 6 when he'd first started, and he pushed himself hard. He worked weekends and evenings, and by 35, as once had been his goal, he'd become a millionaire as well. Dana and I spoke on the phone too, usually twice a week. Sometimes I'd call, but more often than not, my sister would be the one to pick up the phone. She loved talking to Kat. They would talk primarily about the kids and how tiring being a mother could be. And she followed Kat's pregnancy closely. In moments like those, it was easy to forget there was anything wrong with her. Whether my sister was in denial or just an optimist, she downplayed her tumor. Usually she didn't mention it at all. If she did, it was only to tell me that she was going to beat it. "I just know it," she'd say. "I've got 2 kids and they need a mother." "I know," I'd answer. "And you're doing great. Even the doctors admit that." Sometimes when I answered, she'd grow quiet. "You think I'll make it too? don't you, Nick? Of course I do, I'd quickly lie, fighting the lump in my throat. You're going to be just fine. In late December, a few days after Christmas, Micah called, sounding weary, his inflection flat. What's up? I asked. It's Dana, he said. We just got back from our last appointment. He paused. A moment later, into the silence, he began to cry. The tumor's still spreading, he said. Her last CAT scan showed that the new drugs aren't helping at all. I closed my eyes. Micah's voice was trembling and broken. They put her on another regimen anyway, but they don't think it'll work. They're just doing it because they know Dana wants to try something else. They say that her attitude has been the reason she's made it as long as she has, and they don't want to break her spirit. She needs to feel like she's doing something to fight it. But she doesn't know? No, he said. When we left, she told me she was sure that this time the chemo would work. I could feel the lump in my throat, could feel my own tears brimming. Micah continued to cry into the phone. Damn, Nick. She's so young. She's our baby sister. I began to cry as well. How much longer does she have? It was all I could do to get the words out. He took a long breath, trying to get control. They don't know for sure. When I cornered the doctor, though, he said that she might have 6 months, he whispered. Outside, the world was darkening. The sky was filled with stars, and the moon hung white and heavy on the horizon. Leaves rustled in the winter breeze, sounding like ocean waves. It was a beautiful evening, as if all was right in the world. But it wasn't, for with Micah's call, I lost my last sliver of hope. I didn't realize how much I'd been clinging to that improbable hope, and when I hung up with Micah, I slipped a jacket on and went outside. I walked through our yard, thinking of Dana, thinking of how strong and optimistic she'd been, thinking of her kids, thinking of the future that she would never see. And leaning against a tree, I cried into the wind. I spent the next 2 days wandering aimlessly through the house. I'd start something and stop. I'd watch a show for 10 minutes before realizing I didn't know or care about what was on. I'd read the same pages over and over, unable to comprehend the words on the page. 2 days later, the phone rang. Kathy was in the final month of her pregnancy. And after answering it, she brought the receiver to my office. Her eyes spilled over with tears. It's Dana, she said. I took the phone, and as soon as I put it to my ear, I heard my sister begin to sing to me. It was our birthday, and I concentrated hard as I listened to her, wanting to freeze the moment in time, for I knew that it would be the last time we would ever do this for each other. On January 11th, 2000, Landon was born. With green eyes and blonde hair, he looked like his mother, and I was struck by how small he was in my arms. It had been 7 years since I'd held a newborn, and I never wanted to put him down. Yet I had no other choice. I was being pulled by the feelings I had for my other family, and 3 days later I flew to California to see my sister. From that point on, I'd begin flying out to California regularly. In every 2 week period, I'd spend at least 4 days with my sister at the ranch. Because my sister still had hope, and because hope was the only thing keeping her strong, I had to hide my reasons for coming. Though the effects of her tumor were becoming more obvious, she was still sharp enough to notice that I was suddenly visiting regularly, and she would infer the worst. I couldn't do that to her. Her spirits had kept her strong, and I didn't want to worsen the quality of life she had remaining. So in the end, I found myself telling her half-truths. I have to do some work in Los Angeles, I'd say. And since it's only an hour away, I'll pop up and see you. Or, I'm meeting friends in Las Vegas, and since I'm so close to the West Coast, I might as well drop in. Great, Dana would say. I'd love to see you. Micah would always meet me at the airport, and we fell into a routine that hasn't changed. Micah and I would stop at Zelda's, a gourmet pizza parlor in downtown Sacramento, and share a pizza and beers. We'd talk for hours, about writing and his business, about our sister, and we'd share memories of our childhood. We'd laugh and shake our heads and grow suddenly quiet as we thought about Mom or Dad or what was happening to our sister. I'd sleep at Micah's the first night, and in the morning he'd drive me out to the ranch to spend the rest of my time with Dana. On my first visit, my sister continued to pretend that nothing was wrong. She'd cook and clean and ask if I wanted to help Cody and Cole with their homework while she napped. We'd have dinner and visit until she grew tired and finally went to bed. But the progress of her tumor was unstoppable, and little by little there was no disguising it. On each successive visit, her naps began to grow longer and she went to bed earlier. By February, she'd begun to limp. Her tumor was slowly paralyzing the left side of her body. The next time I visited, her left arm had grown weaker as well. A week after that, the left side of her face began to lose its expressive ability. Where she'd once occasionally slurred her words, the slurring now occurred with greater frequency. Abstract comprehension grew even more difficult. My baby sister was slowly losing her battle. But even then, she somehow believed that she would make it. "I'll be okay," she'd say. "I'm going to see Cody and Cole grow up." Now, however, when she made comments like those, it was all I could do not to cry. I was an emotional wreck in those first couple of months of 2000. Torn between seeing Dana and spending time with my new baby, I woke each day thinking I should be somewhere else. If I was holding Landon, I'd wish I was in California holding my sister. And when I held my sister, I wished I was back in North Carolina holding my son. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to balance it all. And I didn't know how long I could keep it up. I barely slept. Tears would suddenly spring to my eyes in unexpected moments. And as I forced myself through the day-to-day motions of my life, I was more exhausted than I'd ever been. When you know that someone close to you is going to die, there's a natural tendency to want to spend as much time with them as you can. As I mentioned, it was a constant struggle to maintain the balance between my current family and the family I'd grown up with. But even if I'd wanted to, there was another reason why I didn't stay in California. My visits, though everyone understood my reasons for coming, changed the dynamics of my sister's house. Guests, even family guests, always altered domestic dynamics. And remember, my sister had a new family of her own as well. Dana had married into a wonderful situation. Bob's father lived on the ranch in a house a stone's throw away. So did Bob's stepmother and half-brother. Bob's mother and stepfather lived less than 10 minutes down the highway. So did Bob's brother. All of them loved my sister, had opened their hearts to her, had accepted her into their lives. And each of them was struggling, just as Micah and I were. And maybe, I've since come to believe, their struggle was even worse than ours. As my sister's tumor progressed and she lost energy to do everything she'd once done, various members of Bob's family moved in and out of the house, quietly filling the void. Someone would always be there doing the dishes, washing laundry, helping with the homework. My sister, in her time of need, was never left alone. I guess what I'm trying to say is that I visited with my sister as much as I thought I could, not how much I wanted to. I did this so that Bob's family would have the chance to spend time with my sister without having me around. They'd earned that right, and in my heart I knew that each of them, especially Bob, also needed time to say goodbye. I came and went, but Micah continued in the role he'd taken over from my dad. He was strong, steady, and supportive despite his fears. And in mid-March, he drove with my sister to San Francisco, where she met with her oncologist. The experimental medication, as the doctors had expected, had had no effect at all. Micah sat beside my sister as the doctor explained that there was nothing left in their arsenals to try. Though they could try another chemotherapy drug, there was little hope that it would do anything, other than make her sleep even more than she already was. By that point, my sister was sleeping 14 to 16 hours a day. If she had another round of chemo, she'd essentially sleep the rest of her life away. At the end of the consultation, Micah said goodbye to the doctor. He held my sister's arm so she wouldn't fall and led her outside. They sat on the steps outside the medical complex. The day was cool, but the sky was blue and clear. On the sidewalks, people passed by without a second glance. cars rolled by steadily, and in the distance one or two of them honked their horns. Everywhere else, life was going on as normal, but for Micah, nothing seemed normal at all. Like me, Micah was exhausted. Yes, he knew it would come to this. We all knew it would come to this. Yet just as we all had at our mother's bedside, we'd never stopped wishing and praying for a miracle. There was no logical reason to expect one, but Dana was our sister, and we loved her. It was the only thing we could do. My sister said nothing. Her left eye drooped, and a bit of saliva leaked from her mouth. She couldn't feel it, didn't even know it was there. Micah gently wiped her mouth. "Hey, sweetie," he said. "Hey," my sister answered quietly. It was no longer her voice. Her words sounded different now, like someone mumbling in her sleep. Micah slipped his arm around her. "Do you understand what the doctor was saying?" Dana looked at him, moving her head slowly. It seemed to be everything she could do to remember. "No more meds?" she finally asked. The words were soft, almost too low to hear. "Yes, sweetie, that's right. No more medicine. You're done with all that." My sister stared at him, trying to follow his words. Her expression saddened, half of her mouth forming a frown. "So that's it?" Micah's eyes immediately welled with tears. It was her way of asking Micah if she was really going to die. "Yes, sweetie, that's it," he whispered. He pulled her close, kissed the top of her head, and Dana leaned into his chest. And for the first time since she'd been diagnosed with the tumor, my little sister began to cry. By late March, even without the chemo, my sister's sleep continued to lengthen, and on my visits I'd sit alone in the kitchen for long periods at a stretch, waiting for her to get up from her nap. In those hours my mind would whirl with thousands of images. How she'd looked as a child, the things we'd done together, the long talks we used to have. We were running out of time and I wanted to wake her. I wanted to spend time with her. I wanted to talk to her. But I never disturbed her rest. Instead, I would go into her bedroom and lie on the bed beside her. I'd run my hand gently through her hair and whisper stories of our childhood, or tell her about Landon, but my sister never stirred. Her breath was heavy and labored like that of someone far older. In time, I would go back to the kitchen and look out the window, seeing nothing at all as I waited for her to wake, while the hours dragged on and on. In the evenings after dinner, we'd sit in the living room and I'd stare at Dana, concentrating on how she looked, wanting to remember her face forever. Time had dimmed the image of my mother. It was already dimming the image of my father, and I didn't want it to happen with my sister. I stared at her, noting the curve of her jaw, her gold-rimmed hazel eyes, the patch of freckles on her cheeks. I concentrated. I forced myself to see everything. To make it real forever. Members of Bob's family would sometimes visit with me in the hours after dinner. One night toward the end of April, Bob's stepmother, Carolyn, and I were talking with Dana, when Dana finally announced she was going to bed. She'd grown steadily worse. For the most part, all she could do was mumble. But she'd smile that half-paralyzed smile of hers, and I was struck by the thought it might be the last normal conversation we'd ever have. As soon as she was behind closed doors, I broke down and cried in Carolyn's arms, sobbing uncontrollably for nearly 20 minutes. In May, the horrible progression seemed to intensify. Dana could no longer hold a fork, so I'd feed her. A week later, she couldn't walk or talk at all. A week after that, she'd been hooked up to a catheter and could ingest only liquids. She'd have to be carried from her room. During my last visit, in mid-May, my family came with me to say goodbye. On our last day in town, I remember bringing Landon into her bedroom. Her eyes were the only feature that had remained immune to the ravages of the tumor, and they shone as I held the baby against her cheek. I held Dana's hand against the baby's skin. She seemed to revel in the sensation. When we were finally alone again, I knelt by the bed, taking my sister's hand in my own. I didn't want to leave her. In my heart, I knew this was the last time I'd ever speak to her.
"I love you,"
I finally whispered. "You're the best person I've ever known," I said, and my sister's eyes softened. With effort, she raised a finger and pointed to me.
"You are,"
she mouthed. Cody and Cole celebrated their 6th birthday the following day. My sister was carried outside and sat in a chair to watch them. That night, she slipped into a coma and never woke again. She died 3 days later. Dana was 33 years old. Dana was buried next to my parents, and the funeral was packed. Again, I saw the same faces in the crowd, faces that had witnessed my mom's and dad's burials. The funerals were the only time I'd seen some of these people in the last 11 years. In the eulogy by the graveside, I told everyone how my sister and I used to sing to each other on our birthday. I told them that when I thought of my sister, I could still hear her laughter, sense her optimism, and feel her faith. I told them that my sister was the kindest person I've ever known, and that the world was a sadder place without her in it. And finally, I told them to remember my sister with a smile, like I did. For even though she was being buried near my parents, the best parts of her would always stay alive, deep within our hearts. Micah had only been to 3 funerals in his life. When the service was over, we stood near the graveside, staring at the flowers covering the coffin. Micah put his arm around me in silence. There was nothing left to say, nor could we cry. At that moment, neither of us had any tears remaining. I could feel the stares of others. I could sense their despair. We were too young to have lost them all, I imagined them thinking. And they were right. It was lonely by the grave. I should have had the rest of my family to lean on in a moment like this. But they were the reason we were here. Standing beside Micah, it dawned on me that we were the only ones left in our family. It was just the two of us now. Brothers. Chapter 17. Tromsø, Norway, February 13th to 14th. We arrived in Tromsø, Norway, a picturesque coastal town located 300 miles north of the Arctic Circle, the following afternoon. Because of the latitude, the sky was already a darkening blue, but the temperature struck me as merely chilly, not cold. Though only 1,000 miles from the North Pole, the coastal waters are warmed by the Gulf Stream, making the winters far milder than other Norwegian cities farther to the south. Boarding the bus, we wound through the town. Tromsø was set amid the mountains, and a layer of snow coated the ground, making the city resemble a Christmas card. The sky was completely black by the time we arrived at our hotel. My watch showed that it wasn't quite 4 o'clock. Immediately after checking in, I went to the hotel computer to email Kat. I'd been emailing her regularly. Because of the time differences, it was often easier to reach her that way, and I typed out a letter, filling her in on what I'd been up to. Then, despite the mountains and cloud cover that would probably limit the use of the phone I brought, I attempted to call her and found her at home. In the past 3 weeks, I'd been on the phone with her less than 12 times, and we seldom spoke more than a few minutes. Though Kat had known it would be hard for her while I was gone, I don't think either of us knew exactly how hard it was actually going to be. I could hear the exhaustion in her voice. She sounded completely spent. When I got back to the room, Micah was lying in bed reading when he looked up at me. "You were gone a long time." "Oh," I said. "I just talked to Kat." "How's she doing? Looking forward to having you home?" "You can say that. It's been horrible while I've been gone." "How so?" "She's been sick and the kids have been sick, pretty much since the moment I left." "Really?"
"Between the 5 kids and her, she's had to deal with 7 colds, 5 flus, and 3 sinus infections. At any given moment over the last 3 weeks, there were 3 sick kids, all of them whining and crying. And get this, despite all that, she took them all on a ski trip. And they had to drive 7 hours to get there, too." He winced. 7 hours in the car with sick kids? Unbelievable. I can't even imagine it. He was silent for a moment. I'll bet she wasn't in the best of moods, huh? Actually, she seemed to be in pretty good spirits. Your wife is nuts. In a good way, of course. But she's definitely nuts. I hate it when the kids whine. It's like fingernails against a chalkboard. Micah shook his head before grinning. Gee, it's a shame that you were traveling the world and weren't around to help her out. Oh, definitely a shame. If only you'd known, right? Exactly, I probably wouldn't have gone, he laughed. Did you tell her to try to make sure they're all better by the time you get home? I didn't want her to kill me. He laughed again. Christine would kill me, too. You guys are going on a vacation in a couple of weeks, just the two of you, right? I nodded. Yeah, we'll spend a few days relaxing at the beach. You know she gets to decide what to do the entire vacation. Oh, I know. I've already figured that out. I mean every bit of it, he added for emphasis. Instead of scuba diving, you'll be browsing through stores for hours looking at kids' clothes. And she'll ask you whether you like the shirt with the pink bunny or the yellow duck, and you have to act as if you're giving the matter a lot of thought. I know. And you'll have to treat her like a queen and pretend you're enjoying yourself. I know. In fact, you're pretty much going to have to grovel. Believe me, I know, I shrugged. But it's only fair. Ah, the trade-offs we have to make, he smiled. Isn't marriage great? In the evening, we rode a gondola up the side of one of the peaks near Tromso. At the top, we made our way to a lodge for a mountaintop cocktail party. With windows lining two walls, we could see the lights of Tromso twinkling in the darkness. Outside the windows, there were snow flurries. It seemed hard to believe that only a few days earlier we'd been sweating in places like Ethiopia, India, and Cambodia. It was our second-to-last night on the tour, and people were beginning to exchange phone numbers and addresses. Everyone was tired but in good spirits. It was hard to believe that our trip was nearly over. Instead of mingling, Micah and I went to sit by the windows. We were in a reflective mood, and watching the snow flurries, we talked about the things we'd seen, the places we'd been. We talked about the places we would visit again. Both of us had Machu Picchu at the top of our list, and how much we were both looking forward to seeing our families again. In time, Micah glanced at me. So how's Ryan doing these days? He's doing well. On his last report card, he got 2 B's and the rest A's. And he's in 3rd grade. Yeah. Does he have more friends now? He's in a great class, I said, and he's been with the same group since kindergarten. The kids in his class are used to him, and they like him. It's nice, and it's funny, too. If you ask the kids how Ryan's doing, they all say that he's the smartest kid in the classroom. Does he play like other kids yet? He's getting better. Socially, he's still a little behind, and he still has a little trouble with regular conversations. He's fine if you talk to him about his interests, but he's not too good at banter or small talk yet. I think part of it, though, is that he's shy. I don't know whether it's because of his problem or whether he would have been shy anyway. It's one of those unanswered questions. You guys have come a long way with him. It's amazing how much better he is. Every time I see him, I notice he's improving all the time. Thanks, I said. I know he's come a long way, but to be honest, it's sometimes hard to remember how bad he once was. We keep focusing on the future. You know, working on his conversations, his reading comprehension, things like that. It's frustrating. You always have to figure out new ways to get through to him. It's not like you can simply give him instructions. He's come a long way, Nick. What you and Kathy have done is amazing. I mean it. Thanks, I said again. Did you ever find out what was wrong with him? I shook my head. No. We have some ideas, but we'll never be certain. Kat thinks he just had CAPD, where he couldn't understand sound, but I'm not so sure. I mean, I've read everything about that disorder, and if Ryan did have it, it was the worst case that I ever came across. I think it might have been part of the problem, but I think there was more to it. I think he was also autistic. But like I said, I don't think we'll ever know for sure. I took a long breath. But we'll keep working, and he'll keep getting better. In the end, I think he'll be able to lead a normal life. I think he'll go to college and get married and make mistakes like all of us. He's close now. He's not there yet, but he's close. And we're not going to give up on him. But sometimes, I hesitated. Micah looked at me. What? Sometimes I wonder why we had a child like Ryan. There was so much going on already with Mom, Dad, and Dana. It was too much, you know? It was too hard. It's like I didn't have enough challenges, so God gave me one more. I paused. Do you know what I always tell Miles and Ryan? He raised his eyebrows. I tell Ryan that God gave him a brother like Miles so that Ryan could learn that anything is possible, and that he could be good at anything. And I tell Miles that God gave him Ryan so that Miles could learn patience and persistence and how to overcome challenges. Micah smiled. That's nice. I shrugged. It was a good lesson, but part of me always wished I wouldn't have had to say it at all. Micah put his hand on my shoulder. I know why God gave Ryan to you and Kat. Yeah? Yeah. Why, because he wanted to test my faith? No, he said quietly. Because not all parents could have done what you two did. He gave you Ryan because he knew that you two were smart and strong enough to help him. Ryan might have been lost with someone else. For a long moment we sat in silence. The snow flurries danced hypnotically and began to coat the window ledges. I thought about Ryan and his struggles, everything he'd been through. Yes, he was better because of the work Kat and I had done. And yes, I was confident about his future. But all at once, despite those thoughts, I felt a lump in my throat. And to be honest, I wasn't sure where it came from. Our evening at the lodge ended relatively early, and Micah and I talked a few others on the tour into visiting one of the pubs in Tromso. There are a lot of pubs in Tromso, by the way. When it's dark 18 hours a day in a relatively small town, there isn't much else to do if a person wants to spend time with friends. And Norwegians, we quickly discovered, are just about the friendliest people in the world. As soon as we found a table, locals gathered around to talk to us and listened as we described the trip we'd just been on. They asked our names and our histories and asked how we liked their town. They offered to buy us drinks and excitedly informed us that there would be karaoke that night. Some of the Norwegians took karaoke very seriously, and gradually the bar began to fill with people who'd come in just to sing. And here I thought karaoke stopped being popular years ago. Shows me how much I know. Now, I've never sung karaoke. I've never wanted to sing karaoke, mainly because I'm a terrible singer. Micah can't sing either, and neither, I eventually learned, could anyone else on our tour. But sing we did. And gradually, we warmed to the idea of performing for these Norwegians. We passed the microphone back and forth, laughing when it was someone else's turn to belt out the next set of lyrics. We did this for hours, and it was one of the best evenings, along with Ayers Rock, that we had on tour. The bar had a large selection of music, including Kenny Rogers' Coward of the County, which made both of us laugh. It had to be an omen, and we belted out that tune at the top of our lungs. We also sang Greased Lightning from the movie Grease, doing our best to hide our off-key singing by dancing as exuberantly as we could. We moved like John Travolta, like professionals on Broadway, like we'd been dancing our entire lives. And at the end, the crowd clapped, whistled, and cheered. Later, when we asked one of the members of our tour what they really thought about our performance, there was a short pause before she answered, "You know those howler monkeys in Guatemala? You look like them." Like I said, all in all, a fabulous night. Our late night made rising early the following morning difficult. We were tired and spent the morning at the museum in Tromso. There we were treated to long discourses on jars and bowls. After the museum, we drove out into the countryside to go dog sledding. There were low-lying hills and trees in every direction. In the distance, the snow-capped peaks were partially hidden by clouds. It was brisk, and we dressed in snowsuits that we could slip over our clothes. To reach the dog sleds, we had to descend a shallow hill, and were given the option of walking or riding down on an inner tube. Most of the people walked. Micah and I rode the inner tubes, about 50 times. We were loaded into the dog sleds in groups of three. Micah and I were joined by Jill, the physician, and as we waited, we were introduced to the dogs. They were huskies, but smaller than I'd imagined they would be, maybe 50 pounds or so. And they were friendly. They seemed to enjoy being stroked and licked at our snowsuits in return. Our driver, a middle-aged woman who'd once placed fifth in the Alaskan Iditarod, had not only trained the dogs, but owned most of the surrounding area. The business of providing dog sled rides enabled her to exercise her dogs daily, and the dogs loved to exercise. As soon as the driver stepped on, the dogs got antsy and started barking. I suppose I expected her to yell mush, but instead, and in a tone no louder than ordinary conversation, she simply said something that sounded like het. The dogs started pulling and the sled took off, dogs trotting ahead and looking around. There are a few things about dog sledding you should know. First, the sled is slow, extremely bumpy, and hard on the rear end. Second, you're seated in such a way to make you feel every bit of the ride. And finally, saying that you went dog sledding in Norway with the team that once competed in the Iditarod is more fun than the sledding itself. But hey, we did it, and took lots of pictures, too. And now when I stand at a party, I can say things like, "Yes, I remember the time I was dog sledding in the Norwegian Alps, training the team for the Iditarod, going hard with the snow swirling in my eyes, my lead dog limping but gamely carrying on, my face growing numb in the cold, and I remember thinking..." Pause. It's even better than the, "I remember the time I was riding the elephants on my way to ancient Amber Fort in Jaipur, the heat beating down, the elephant growing weary as we mounted the final crest, and I remember thinking" story. After riding the dog sled, we joined our tour companions under a teepee. Inside, they were serving reindeer stew that had been cooked over an open fire. The teepee was smoky, but it was warm and the food was enticing, especially after the morning we'd spent. Sadly, we were informed that because of the ever-deepening cloud cover, our chance to see the Aurora Borealis was next to nil. In fact, we would learn that the northern lights had been rare all winter. The chance to see them had been the reason for our visit to Tromsø in the first place, and both Micah and I were disappointed. We were, however, offered a chance to go to yet another museum, but Micah and I were museumed out by then. Instead, we spent the rest of the afternoon wandering the streets of Tromsø, talking and taking in the sights. "Did you ever wonder why things happened the way they did?" Micah asked, apropos of nothing. "All the time," I responded, knowing exactly what he was referring to. "Most of my friends haven't lost anyone close to them. Neither of mine, and Kat hasn't either. Why is that?" "Who knows? I wish I could tell you, but I can't." Micah pushed his hands into his pockets. "Have you ever noticed that people think of us as experts on death now? I mean, whenever a friend has someone die, he or she always calls me to talk. Does that happen to you?" "All the time," I answered. "What do you say?" "It depends. I never know what to tell them. I mean, there's nothing you can say to make a person stop hurting. Half the time, I just feel like telling them the truth. I'd say that for 3 months, you're going to feel worse than you've ever felt, and you cope as best you can. And that after 6 months, the pain isn't so bad, but it still hurts more than you think it will. And even after years, you still find yourself thinking about the person you lost and get sad about it. And you still miss them all the time." "Why don't you say that?" "Because that's not what people want to hear. They want to hear that it's going to be okay, that the pain goes away. But it doesn't. It never does. And you can't say that when the wound is fresh. It would be like pouring salt in their wound, and you can't do that to a person. So instead, I tell them what they want to hear." He paused. "What have all those losses taught you?" "That it hurts, but you've got to go on anyway. That's what I learned, too. But you know, I would rather have learned it a lot later in life." "Me too." "You know what else I learned?" Micah asked. "What's that?" "That it's a cumulative thing. Mom's and Dad's deaths were hard, but it's like when you lose both of them, it's not only twice the loss, it's exponential. And then when we lost Dana, it wasn't like we'd lost three people we loved. It's like we lost almost everything." Micah shook his head before going on. "After something like that, well, even though you try to get through it, it might seem fine on the surface. Underneath, you're a wreck and you don't even know it. And sometimes it takes a while to figure out that you're still struggling with everything that happened." I nudged his shoulder. "You talking about me again?" "No, not just you," he said. "Me too." "Like you said,
We just reacted to the loss in different ways.
After our sister's death, Micah changed. It was as if he'd suddenly become intimately aware of the fragility of life and how precious time really was. As a result, he made a conscious effort to simplify his life, with the goal of eliminating unnecessary stress. No longer interested in society's definition of success, he began purging his life of material things. Life, he decided, was for living, not for having, and he wanted to experience every moment that he could. At the deepest level, he'd come to understand that life could end at any moment, and it was better to be happy than busy. He began selling things, getting rid of the clutter. Within a couple of months, he'd sold both businesses and converted his investments to cash. He sold both his boat and his Jeep. He recommitted himself to his family, and when he called me, he explained his reasoning as follows. "The more you own, the more it owns you, and I'm tired of it. I'm tired of having to take care of everything. I'm tired of things breaking and having to fix them. It adds stress, and frankly, I'm giving myself a break." In the end, he kept the basics. His house, his car, and his furniture. The sale of his businesses left him with more than enough money to meet his monthly obligations, for years if he had to, and for the next 8 months he did nothing that might add unwanted pressure to his life. In some ways, he reverted to the young man he'd been during his college years. He went camping and hiking, he rafted during the summer, and as soon as snow began falling in the Sierras, he snowboarded. He took a trip to Puerto Vallarta with Christine. He visited Cody and Cole at the ranch. He began exercising regularly again and joined an indoor soccer league. He also made a point to see me as often as he could. When I had a meeting in Los Angeles, my brother flew down to spend a few days with me. When my tour brought me through Sacramento later that fall, he came with me to the promotional events. In December, 6 months after my sister passed away, Micah visited me in North Carolina with Christine and his stepdaughter Allie. Bob also came, along with Cody and Cole. Our three families took a trip to New York, and we stood atop the World Trade Center admiring the view, less than 9 months before it would be reduced to rubble. 3 weeks after our trip to New York, my brother called me. It was my birthday, and as soon as I answered the phone, he began to sing to me, in the same way my sister always had. I listened with my eyes closed, remembering it all. "I guess I'll have to do this for you now," he said when he finished. "It's a tradition, you know." I smiled, missing my sister, but thankful for my brother. "Thanks, Micah." "No problem, little brother." There was one other way in which my brother changed as well. While he still went to church, his attendance became sporadic and continued to diminish as time went on. And on those days he did go, he sat in the pew and felt nothing. With my sister's death, my brother had lost his faith. I, too, had suddenly become aware of the fragility of life and the preciousness of time. But as similar as Micah and I were in many ways, my reaction was exactly the opposite. I came to believe that because life could end at any moment, I had to be prepared for any eventuality. I wanted to make sure my family was taken care of no matter what might happen in the future. I had goals, and with the clock ticking, I had to hurry up and meet them before the unthinkable occurred. There was suddenly no time to waste. I had to hurry. I had to get things ready. I had to work. I had to go. Less than 2 weeks after my sister's funeral, I began to work on a bend in the road, a story inspired by my brother-in-law, Bob. It was the story of a young widower with a child, and I forced myself to sit at the computer for days on end to finish it. That fall, I toured Europe and the United States to promote the rescue. And as soon as the edits on A Bend in the Road were completed in early 2001, I began The Guardian, which would eventually become my longest and most challenging book to date. Little by little, work on the novel began to consume me. I'd become so used to stress in the last 11 years that it was as if I didn't know how to function without it. And from that point on, I continually added more to my plate. In January 2001, we found out that Kat was pregnant again. A few months later, we learned she was having twin girls. After three boys, it was definitely exciting, and expecting twins seemed appropriate considering the sudden increase in the pace of life. I became the master of scheduling, Every minute was planned for during the course of a day. Time was not to be wasted, even when I didn't work, for my responsibilities